Go to Congress.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to open the House Committee on Business and Labor for this Wednesday, March 11th. We're going to start out with an informational meeting this morning. And so the committee knows we are not working House Bill, I have to get my glasses, 2805, and we are not working House Bill 2386 today. Those will be carried over until Friday. So with that, I'll open the informational hearing on the high cost of low wages. And
take notes on this one.
They're coming up without me calling them up, but I'm glad they are. Ellen Scott, Daniel Morrison, Rahi Reddy?
Yes.
So if you could introduce yourself now that I already have, but introduce yourself for the record before you start, please.
Good morning, Chair Holby, Vice Chair Kenemer, Vice Chair Barton, who's not here, and members of the House Committee on Business and Labor. My name is Rahi Reddy, and I'm a faculty member at the Labor Education and Research Center at the University of Oregon. Did you want us all each to introduce ourselves first, or do you want me to go
well,
ahead?
Well, just as they start speaking,
okay,
they
yeah.
can. But you can move back, move
sure.
that mic away from you.
Okay.
Those are very sensitive mics. And
I'm also very loud, so.
It distorts if you get too close.
Okay.
It's better.
Thank you. Our center delivers education programming and conducts applied research on vital social issues related to work and employment. We are really excited to be here with you today and to share the findings of our latest research, The High Cost of Low Wages in Oregon. We began this research project in earnest in 2014. Like many of you, we too wanted to understand how this economy is developing, and in particular, wanted to understand the rise of the low-wage sector. The Office of the State Economist published a sobering report in 2013 studying 30 years of job growth in the state and confirmed what we believe to be true, that middle-wage jobs are disappearing, and the jobs that are replacing them are low-wage jobs that cannot support a family the way middle-wage employment had done in decades past. In the state's job analysis, low-wage jobs were defined as those that earn less than $25,000 a year for a full-time worker. This translates into an hourly rate of about $12 an hour or less. In our estimates, over 400,000 Oregonians earn these low wages. For the sake of consistency, our report uses the state's definition of low wage, though we believe it yields conservative estimates of the number of Oregonians earning low wages. As you will hear today, many low-wage workers are unable to find regular full-time work, making it difficult to even make these annual earnings, even at $12 an hour. And as the cost of basic necessities continually rise, yearly earnings of $25,000 a year still does not afford families the economic security they need to make ends meet and avert financial disaster. The national discussion we've been having about the rise of income inequality and its impact on the nation was also compelling to us as we conceptualized this study. There is a growing consensus among economists and policymakers, everyday Americans, and even nation's millionaires that income inequality is limiting our nation's economic progress. But again, we come back to the Oregon picture. What does low-wage work and the growing prevalence of it in our state mean for everyday Oregonians? Our study examines what low-wage work is in Oregon, including what industries have the greatest reliance on low-wage workers. We also go deeper and ask the question of what the true costs are of the growing low-wage sector here to workers who are employed in these jobs, their families, and to the state that provides programs that help these workers remain housed and avoid hunger. Are there costs to all Oregonians when workers earn wages that fall below what is needed to afford basic needs like housing, food, childcare, and having a small savings cushion to avoid financial disaster? Our colleagues at the University of California, Berkeley, the University of Wisconsin, and the University of Illinois have produced state studies exploring the costs to states for providing public assistance to working adults when their wages fall so low that they qualified for these programs. We wanted to understand that picture in Oregon as well. Our report is unique compared to other state studies. We're really proud about that. We developed our analysis first from available state and national data on low-wage employment in Oregon. And we complete that picture with findings from a series of interviews we conducted with low-wage working Oregonians. These interviews give us a window into the daily struggles of everyday Oregonians trying to survive on low wages and unstable employment. We've been able to weave together a much more comprehensive picture of low-wage work lived on the ground, as well as seen in economic trends. We know that our report is just the beginning of a conversation. There is much more to explore. But we know that it's imperative we get a full understanding of the problems of low-wage work. The urgency of tackling this issue is now. Low-wage occupations are some of the fastest-growing jobs in the state, making the need to understand these issues even more urgent. We also know that if we do not understand the many true costs of low-wage work to workers, their families, and to the state, then it's difficult to develop the kind of robust solutions we need to help Oregonians move forward. We really look forward to having this dialogue with you today. I'd like to now turn it over to my colleague, Dr. Ellen Scott, to talk a little bit more about the interviews she's done with low-wage working Oregonians.
Thank you for your time today, committee. We really, really appreciate being here and being able to discuss these issues with you. My name is Ellen Scott. I'm on the faculty in sociology at the University of Oregon. And today I'm going to share some findings from interviews that I conducted with 44 low-income parents in Western Oregon. And in their own words, they tell us about the challenges that they face trying to get by on their low wages. And I'll highlight today a number of common challenges, such as erratic schedules, lack of sick leave, the trouble with arranging child care, and frequent job changes and periods of unemployment, all of which result in great difficulty in making ends meet on low wages. The parents we interviewed were typical of low-wage workers in Oregon, and briefly, over half of minimum wage workers in Oregon are women. Contrary to popular belief that low-wage workers are teens, the average age of a minimum wage worker is 35 years old. And of course, race still matters in employment. In Oregon, people of color represent 20% of all low-wage workers, and an urban-rural divide persists. People residing outside metropolitan areas are much more likely to be employed in low-wage jobs. Exactly half of the workforce in Eastern Oregon earns less than $10 an hour. The parents we interviewed worked in some of the most common low-wage occupations in Oregon. They worked in retail, fast food and food services, manufacturing, and personal and health care services. They typically had fewer hours than they wanted. Their jobs were often temporary or seasonal, and they had unpredictable schedules and non-standard hours. Based on their reports of hours and wages, we estimated that their average monthly income was $1,300 gross per month, a shockingly low wage, especially since these were families with three children and usually single-parent households. $1,300 is not nearly enough, as you know, to cover housing, food, childcare costs for three children, let alone transportation, medical expenses, and other necessities. It's no wonder that so many low-wage workers rely on public assistance. And all the parents that we spoke with did receive child care subsidies. That was by definition in the original study. And most received SNAP benefits, food stamp benefits, and some got a housing subsidy. Quite simply, they could not manage without these state benefits. In their case, critical work supports that allow them to sustain their families despite earning such low wages. Low-wage workers, including the majority of those we interviewed, contend with erratic employment schedules and non-standard shifts. This makes it very hard to organize daily life, especially life with children. Having flexible caregivers is a requirement in managing this life of erratic work schedules. And for many, finding such caregivers can be impossible. And as a result, many of our respondents were unable to take or stay in jobs with these demands. Some were allowed to have input into their new schedule, but most did not have this privilege. Terry, a single mother, and I use pseudonyms, Terry, a single mother of two who worked in a large box store, told us they'd say you're going to have a set schedule and you'd work the schedule for 2 months and everybody's happy and the kids are well adjusted, and then we're going to change the schedule. Terry was able to manage her constantly changing schedule in large part because her mother, who was able to be completely flexible, took care of her children and was paid through employment-related daycare. However, finding a replacement for her mother after she died was extremely difficult because of the flexibility that Terry required. Some parents also had regular shifts, but in order to accrue enough hours each week or month, they worked also on call, which meant irregular days and shifts again. So Jill, a Native American single mother with some college education, had worked as a janitor for a large nonprofit doing three graveyard shifts and one swing shift each week. And then she did varying days and doubles to fill in when employees were absent. She said, "I work with one agency, but in that one agency, I've got a regular job and three on-call jobs, and another agency is just on call." This life of erratic scheduling was possible again for Jill because she either took her son to her mother's for subsidized care or she left her son at home when her roommate was there. The low-wage workers that we interviewed typically did not have workplace benefits. Paid sick leave was something most couldn't count on, and their stories were riddled with the difficulties of caring for sick children by themselves or for themselves when they were sick. In fact, some had lost jobs as a result of not having paid sick leave. Tabitha, a mother of two, worked in manufacturing doing 12-hour nighttime shifts. Her job was not family-friendly. Each minute that she arrived late or missed a day due to illness counted towards a tally of work time missed. And this was very difficult for her because she did have a son with asthma, and she sometimes had to stay home with him. She ultimately lost this job due to her absences, and when we interviewed her, she had been unemployed for a year. She had not been receiving TANF, and she had also lost her child care subsidy in that time, and the lack of child care made it very difficult for her to seek another job. Low wages, erratic schedules, and a lack of sick leave create a situation where it's hard to get ahead and even stay employed. Job instability, that is, moving from job to job or periods of unemployment, is a critical problem for low-wage workers, and the majority of our respondents experienced both job changes and or spells of unemployment during the two-year period that we reviewed. And they did so for a variety of reasons. Their jobs were temporary. They sought better jobs in order to make ends meet. They were let go after periods of missed work due to illness or family crisis, or the job ended due to the recession or industry decline, or finally, the employer just simply didn't provide a reason. And Tori, an African-American single mother of one, had cycled through a number of jobs through the TANF program. All of these jobs were temporary. None transpired into permanent jobs. Eventually, she found work in Subway, but the job was completely inflexible. She was allowed no time off for illness, and she had to have a scheduled surgery. She told her boss in advance. He still fired her. She said, "I was fired. I was let go because I had surgery." And then she spent a little bit of time on unemployment, found another job. That job only lasted 3 weeks because her mother got sick. Her mother was the only caregiver for her child, so she had to stay out of work again, and she was fired. Suzanne had done seasonal work for a vegetable company for 5 years, and she was laid off every year. That was part of her annual work plan. However, she stayed with this because she was told that this would eventually lead to a full-time job. So she was very committed 5 years into getting one of those coveted positions. Because their wages were so low, their hours often part-time, and their workplace benefits lacking, the parents we interviewed were forced to rely on various combinations of public benefits. Perhaps the most important of these was the child care subsidy. However, even with subsidies, parents who worked erratic schedules or non-standard hours were sometimes forced to choose providers who were unreliable or who did not provide high-quality care. And finding stable child care is imperative for working parents, especially for single parents. Arranging reliable, trustworthy, high-quality care is particularly challenging for parents who have low earnings and challenging schedules. All of the parents that we interviewed did have a child care subsidy, and they consistently told us this was critical for them in order to work. Simply put, their earnings were too low for them to pay for child care. So Martha told us there's no way, if you didn't have state care babysitting, that I could afford $600 or $700 a month, $800 a month in child care costs with two kids. I barely make $900, and that's with $324 in my son's child support. And Mary, who worked at a rehabilitation facility as a CNA, said, I could work, but I'd be living out of a box or my car, because how do you pay for rent and pay for your daycare? I'm so glad that we have this subsidy, so then I can work and do what I'm supposed to do. The parents we interviewed struggled to make ends meet with low-wage work. They've juggled multiple jobs. They had extra shifts. They accommodated just-in-time scheduling. They did graveyard shifts. They had changing schedules. And despite all of this, they still managed somehow to negotiate child care and family life. But still, their wages were too low, and their hours were too few. They were inadequate for them to support their families. Some tried to escape their low-wage jobs through higher education, only to incur substantial debt and no improved access to jobs. They told us that they felt they were doing everything that they were supposed to do, but they couldn't overcome the obstacles. Indeed, they were very often one step away from catastrophe, such as homelessness or debilitating illness or disability. And I have stories that I could share to illustrate that. But I'll leave you with the hope that these stories help you as you consider the difference that higher wages could make for Oregon's poorest workers, the importance of subsidizing child care for low-wage workers parents, since the market cost of care is truly unreachable for them, the importance of paid sick leave, of course, or at least unpaid leave, so that parents don't risk their jobs when they stay home to care for children or for themselves, and finally, the difference that stable schedules and advance notice of variable schedules would make for families trying to manage in these jobs. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Dr. Daniel Morris. I'm the research director for Our Oregon. I also hold a faculty appointment at Portland State University in the School of Community Health. Our Oregon represents a number of organizations and individuals who care about a range of issues, from preserving funding for critical services and education to protecting the environment. I personally conduct research on a number of different topics, ranging from public assistance, government finances, education, and public health, just to name a few. Today, I'd like to tell you a little bit more about the findings, again, the findings in our report. Based on data on 197,000 working adults in Oregon who received SNAP food stamps in January of 2014, I estimate that the total cost of providing public assistance to working families in Oregon exceeds $1.7 billion per year. And I'd like to talk a little bit more about how we got to that number and then to put those findings in the context of what's been happening in Oregon's economy. So these data came from the state Department of Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority track this information. They provided us with information on the number of basically the number of working adults receiving SNAP who work primarily in each industry. And although we didn't get specific business names, these industry categories are very specific. So, for example, we can distinguish fast food restaurants from other restaurants. Among this 197,000 people, their average wages were about $12.36 an hour in 2013. So over 1 million Oregonians received SNAP benefits in 2013. Many of them actually also received assistance through other programs as well. About 78% of SNAP recipients also received medical assistance benefits, for example. So by using statistics on the concurrent use of programs, we're able to take those SNAP data and extrapolate them to look at other public assistance costs as well. The three major programs that we focused on were SNAP, the food stamp program, medical assistance programs, and employment-related daycare. We didn't look at subsidized housing. Therefore, these estimates we consider conservative because we didn't include those in this. So of this $1.7 billion number, it wasn't surprising to us to find that over 60% of these workers worked primarily in four major industry categories. And I just want to run through them just briefly. So the top is the accommodation and food services category. Most of these people work in restaurants, about 13,000 in fast food restaurants and about 12,000 in other kinds of restaurants. Another 5,000 workers worked mostly at hotels and motels. A close second is the retail trade sector. This covers grocery stores, supermarkets, big box stores, gas stations. Again, this is not surprising. One national study estimates that public assistance just to Walmart workers across the country exceeds $6 billion per year. I should note that a few years ago, when the Department of Human Services released a list of the top employers of adults on food stamps, Walmart was on the top of the list. Next up is the healthcare and social assistance sector. Here, most of these workers are working to provide assistance to people who are elderly or have disabilities, whether in the home or at a residential assisted living or nursing retirement community. Thousands more also work at hospitals kind of outpatient care centers and child care both in this sector. And then finally, sort of rounding out the big four, is the administrative and support services sector, which covers temp agencies, telemarketing bureaus, call centers, janitorial, and landscaping services. So these are companies that support businesses in the state. So to put those numbers in context, I just want to talk a little bit about what's been happening in Oregon's economy. And from a kind of a high level, the economy is actually looking really good. Our gross state product, which is a measure of the size of the economy, has been growing about three times faster than the U.S. economy. I think that's a really positive sign that we can be happy about. Unfortunately, while the economy has grown, most families in Oregon are actually worse off than they used to be. This graph shows data from the Oregon Department of Revenue. These are from personal income tax filings. What I've done is compare the average income for each income percentile in 2002 and 2012. And what I hope you can see is that basically for the bottom three quarters of the income distribution, those taxpayers have seen their real income decline over this 10-year period, while income gains have really been limited to the upper end of the distribution. And, of course, the greatest gains have been among the top 1%. What we see when we look closer at these data is that those households that have the highest incomes get most of that income in the form of capital gains, dividends, and taxable interest. So this is income that is that comes from owning lots of financial assets. So as the economy has grown and the gross state product has grown so quickly, the share of that product going to corporate profits has gone up. So more and more of those economic gains are being captured by economic profits, and correspondingly, less and less are going a smaller and smaller share are going to employee wages and benefits. These are Oregon data from Bureau of Economic Analysis. With corporations getting more, a larger and larger share of the profit, corporate profits today are at record highs, and those profits again are being shared primarily with the wealthy shareholders who own most of the stocks, and which is what's been one of the main factors driving our income inequality that we see. So I just want to talk again just briefly, just to wrap up about some of the ways that corporations have been increasing profits. I think the first thing I'd like to point to is outsourcing. Over the past few decades, major corporations in the U.S. have outsourced millions of jobs. For the most part, these are not jobs that have just been made obsolete by technology. They've just been moved to other countries where workers get paid less. Since there are the manufacturing sector has been the hardest hit by outsourcing across the country, and with millions of these middle-wage jobs disappearing, of course, there's more competition for the jobs that remain, which means that companies can get away with paying workers less, offering fewer benefits, and relying more on part-time workers instead of hiring full-time staff. In addition, these companies have gotten very good at avoiding taxes. Bloomberg News reports that major U.S. corporations have now stashed over $2 trillion. That's $2 million dollars in foreign subsidiaries. And this lets these companies reduce their state and federal tax bills by billions of dollars every year. In addition to the kind of the national picture, Oregon, two recent independent reports found that Oregon has the country's lowest effective business taxes. So even though we are, taxpayers in general are subsidizing the workforce of profitable companies, corporate profits have never been higher, the assistance that we're able to offer is limited because we collect relatively little in taxes from businesses compared to other states. And of course, it's not just an assistance; it's also limits funding for other for education and other essential services. So with that, I would just like to again thank you very much for your interest in our research. I'd be happy to answer any questions today, or be happy to serve as a resource for this committee in your work. So thank you very much.
Thank you for that presentation. It was interesting. Questions from the committee? Representative Kinnemer.
I have lots of concerns about what you had to say, but the session started off with robust solutions. I don't think I've heard the robust solutions. I've heard lots of accusations, lots of concerns, lots of problems, but I haven't heard the robust solutions.
If I may. So, Chair Holvey, Representative Kinnemer. I think it's a really good point. I know that there are lots of efforts going on this session to explore solutions for our economy. The purpose of this academic report was not was not necessarily to offer policy prescriptions, but more to lay out the problem and identify and provide meaningful data to inform a discussion. And so that's really why we're here today. But we're happy to support various efforts that are going on relating to specific bills or discussion.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
And I appreciate that. I think it's important. I think some of this research is interesting, but I also, as one who's has a PhD and has studied research, I think it's extraordinarily biased. Mm-hmm. And I'm just, I wish the world were that simple, and it sounds like the solutions are more public services to these low-income people, and that's what I'm hearing in the discussion, and I'm just wondering, is that really what you're advocating? Because we already have all of these programs that are subsidizing and helping these people scrape by, and I would not disagree with that. I feel very badly. I grew up in poverty before we had these programs. Mm-hmm. So I think I understand this firsthand. It's very personal. On the other hand, how are these people? I don't hear the robust solutions to help them or us get them out of that. Mm-hmm.
Representative Holvey, Representative Kinnemer, thank you for these. We couldn't agree more that the policy solutions are going to be very complex, but I think we would probably be doing a bit of a disservice to our own report and the message if we left you thinking that the message is more services. I think more our point here is that we are doing perhaps a disservice to taxpayers to be so highly subsidizing extraordinarily profitable corporations so that they can continue to employ people at, frankly, ridiculously low wages. So there are a couple of things that you'll be considering this year. Certainly there's the increased minimum wage bills that are going to be coming before you. There are some bills that are going to look at paid sick leave. And those are critical pieces of this story. I think shifting to corporations some of that burden of families earning an income that allows them to support their families. And we're 30 or so years post an era where that was something that many workers could take for granted, right? But we've moved out of that. We've created a whole low-wage job sector. We've eliminated those jobs where wages were high enough, benefits were decent. And so really looking to policy solutions that can start to restore, the service sector's not going away, right? It's really a matter of having those jobs be jobs that people can sustain themselves in and not having that sustenance coming out of taxpayers' pockets, rather dipping a little bit more into corporate profits to sustain that.
Thank you. And I appreciate Representative Kinnemer's perspective as usual. Yeah, but I think some of the things I'm seeing here is you actually have hard data that really reflects the wage disparity or the income disparity more accurately. And it appears on the graphs that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. you know, just in simple terms. And, you know, that's due to a lot of things probably, but economic structures and tax policies and the like. And so I think that, I mean, that piece of it seems pretty apparent that, you know, we have a problem because with that continuing kind of dynamic, we will be faced with how do we take care of people if their income levels aren't good enough to so they can take care of themselves. And I think that's, you know, something I'm seeing in this.
If I can offer just an additional comment on that, you know, on the other hand, I don't think it's that simple. I'm thinking about my neighbors who are highly educated and make substantial amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
And they have three small children. And I think they would say that their lives are very difficult because getting help with those children is very difficult. And when those kids are sick, they lose substantial pieces of income,
mm-hmm.
And tremendous inconvenience. And frankly, they suffer enormous guilt on lots of interesting levels. So I don't think it's just an income issue. I think it's a much broader issue than that.
Representative Nose.
I have a comment and then a question, Mr. Chair, if I may. I would just encourage my colleagues to read the report because all of the data that they are sharing with us is cited and it's generated from various state agencies that we all operate and utilize. And so it's just information that they've collected and culled from the various agencies that we, you know, fund and operate for a lot of these programs that they kind of highlighted before us. My question, though, is I believe I heard the presenter say that 1.6 million of Oregonians are on SNAP. Did I understand that correctly?
Chair Hovey, Representative Nose, in 2013, over 1 million Oregonians received SNAP benefits.
Okay, so follow up. I mean, that's a lot of people. Can you tell me how many of those folks are working?
Chair Hovey, Representative Nose. We looked at data on 197,000 working adults who are receiving SNAP, and this is at a kind of a single snapshot for 1 month, and so that's the number that we are that the estimates are based on.
Right on. Okay. Thank you,
Representative Fagan.
Thank you again. This is a great report, and I also have read the report and really appreciate the thoroughness of your report. The industry sectors that you talked about, the four major ones, appear to me to be dominated kind of by larger corporations. Do you have any data indicating what percentage of small businesses in Oregon, or people working for small businesses in Oregon, you know, make less than or making minimum wage? Because it seems to me that they would be the larger businesses that would be dominated by paying the minimum wage.
And your perception is correct. I don't have Daniel's looking for the exact numbers, but that is correct that most of these workers are employed by larger corporations.
Yes, Chair Holder, Representative Fagan. So I have data from the Oregon Employment Department. These are from the first quarter of 2014. Basically, they're – I'm just looking at these now. So of the of workers who make, say, less than $10 an hour, it seems that maybe like less than a quarter of them work for companies with less than 10 employees. I'm happy to provide the table to you to look through it. But those data are available. If you tell me a specific threshold, I think one of the challenges is sort of where do you draw the line? What constitutes a small business or a large business? You know, we know that most of the employees who are making low wages work for larger companies, over 100 employees.
A follow-up.
Just out of curiosity, for your table, could you, like, 50 or more employees, what's the percentage?
50 or more employees. Sorry. Sorry, I should have this written down somewhere. So...
You could certainly follow up with that information.
The majority is companies over 100 employees.
It'd be interesting to see how that breaks out with 100 employees, 50 employees, and 25 employees, for example. Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair Hovey. Members of the committee, thank you for the report. I think it helps provide a piece of a larger puzzle. I just want to take this moment because of some comments made earlier to share what I happen to think are the answers to the robust response. Somewhere along the line, between the 1960s and today, we have decided as a society it's okay to have a disconnect between production, productivity, and profitability. And I want to emphasize that the time that everybody looks to as the good old days of the best economic development, the best economic times we ever had, was built by the World War II generation that survived the Great Depression because government stepped in and helped. They fought a war, won a war in 38 months against two foes across the globe, and then as a group recognized that everybody benefited when people had jobs and we were united in trying to make sure that everybody could get along. Those were the days when the profitability of the CEO was maybe 25 to 30 times more than the factory worker, not 300 times more than the factory worker. So what I suggest, what I ask for, and what I would encourage future studies to be on is finding a way to reconnect profitability and productivity. The second piece is finding a way that's good for business and good for workers to bring that however many trillion dollars that are currently hiding overseas back, and if that means giving cuts to bring it back, I think that that money is currently being used not in our country to build bridges and do other things, being used in other countries. And the third thing that is something I think we need to get at is that I think it's time to redefine patriotism. Patriotism is not a military contractor that sells billions of dollars to the United States military moving its headquarters to Dubai. Patriotism is actually recognizing that we are in this together and that the economics of the marketplace that we like to talk about, Adam Smith, David Ricardo actually had something to say as well. The immobility of capital is key to making sure that the market system can work. As a free market person, I believe in the immobility of capital as a key component of that, and I believe that people should be rewarded for work, and that I'm comfortable with a society where there are very wealthy as long as we have a society that does never have the very, very poor. And I think that's our effort, to try to find relationships where we can reconnect the benefits and the shared interests of a community. And that's what I'm looking forward to working on this committee.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have probably more questions and comments here than I could answer, and I don't know if you're going to be available afterwards. But it seems that the solution that you're looking for is more good jobs available for people to work. I mean, is that good? So since I've been in this committee for the last 5 weeks, we've had issues like on the employer, 7 paid sick days, 8 hours free time given to them a year, opening up potential litigation for the employer over wage issues, BOLI shutting down job sites without due process, SAFE, state accident being challenged to increase its cost through further litigation opportunities. So, I mean, a lot of these things are policy issues that affect business. Is this important to you in order to bring more good jobs into Oregon? See, there's a problem when we start putting a larger burden on employers, and we say, look, if we have this great pool of workers here in Oregon that are just waiting to jump in and produce some product, why aren't we having corporations run to Oregon to say, let's take advantage of this?
That's what I'm saying. So, Chair Holby, Representative Barreto, I think it's a really interesting question. What comes to mind are there are surveys that are done of corporate executives who are in charge of locating factories or plants, and invariably the top two most important factors to them that they consistently report, they look for an educated workforce and good transportation infrastructure to move their goods to market. And in both of those cases, I think Oregon is really, we're not doing as much as, I mean, at least I guess we like to. You know, we're, our education system's really underfunded, both in K-12 and higher ed. We have huge funding gaps. We really need billions of dollars to kind of get us up to optimal level. And our transportation infrastructure is also sort of crumbling. We're, you know, billions of dollars worth of federal transportation funds are going away. The American Society of Civil Engineers reports that about a quarter of the bridges in the state are either the words they use are, well, they're either going to fall down or they're just in a kind of inadequate to handle the traffic. So I think it's, I think you can make a case that with greater investment in our kind of core infrastructure, it actually makes the state much more attractive to businesses to locate here.
Follow up. With this argument that you're giving, though, I mean, this is the chicken and the egg theory. Where are you going to get the money to do this when all of the money is going to social programs? And then you have to also look at, you know, what Representative Evans brought up. He said, look, right now this isn't what it was like 50 years ago. We are in a worldwide market right now, and people are competing on a worldwide level. So, you know, in order for a corporation to keep costs down, you see Nike making all their shoes overseas. You see Columbia Sportswear making all their product overseas. Is one of your objectives to bring that manufacturing back to be able to create more jobs here so that you can sell these products out when the reason they do it overseas is to cut the cost?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what I would add, and thank you again for these questions, it's a really critical part of the conversation, but one of the things that I think is important to look at is, again, the profits, and one of the things that's contributing to the corporate profits these days is the tax policy that we now have. And just returning to tax policy of the Reagan era would change dramatically the revenues that both states and the federal government have to work with to answer these questions. You're right. We can't stop people from employing people all over the globe, but domestically, you know, going back to an era of greater regulation is something I think worthy of consideration.
So, Chair Hulvey, Representative Barreto, one other point that I think is just really important. I think we're really excited that our report is a conversation starter, and it's a really good point to begin this conversation. But one thing I'd like to draw attention back to is, you know, this report is really about the working Oregonians that we interviewed and the experiences that they have in their work lives. And you know, we leave it up to you as lawmakers, as advocates, to come up with how do you take this information and really understand the economy from the point of how these workers are experiencing the economy and experiencing all of the trends. And it's for us, you know, we look at these industries, we look at these sectors, and they are place-based. They are, you know, place-based sectors that, you know, our contention is Subway will be here, Burger King will be here, and what we're trying to really show in this report is understanding the impact of these economic trends on the lives of working people, and are there solutions that we could really address from being place-based, being here in Oregon. So, thank you.
Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you. I'll try to keep my comment brief, I guess. And I think there are enormous causes for this, and one of them happens to be the legislature. I served in the previous century here, and in the 80s and the 90s, we basically killed the forest industry. And it breaks my heart to go to Reedsport and see half the stores closed, and half the stores that are open are secondhand shops. And used to, there was a brand new four-wheeler in every drive. And, you know, not the greatest jobs. I would not want to have worked in that huge plywood mill at Gardner. But they paid well. And people had jobs. And we had good resources. Now we have a forest we're scared spitless is going to burn up. And all of those logging roads that we used to play on are locked up. And Douglas County, Elaine County, a host of others of these western counties, and some eastern counties are going broke because this used to give money. I used to be a county commissioner. We got a huge amount of money from the public lands that were logged in those days. Those are all gone. And gone are those livable wage, in fact, more than livable wage jobs. And I just, you know, so there are a lot of policies that need careful consideration.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just something that would help us tremendously here on your studies and stuff, because we understand the worker part and you can go back and forth on that. Because we increase minimum wage to $15, where now our child care, everything else goes up. I mean, everything goes up once you do that on the low end. I'm just wondering if you could, when you're doing your studies and research, look at what does it take to get some of those corporations that are paying well, because Nike pays great, Intel pays great. A lot of these big corporations pay their people well, and they do a lot for their people. Can you find out why we're losing that business to other states? What do we need to do to be competitive? Talk with Business Oregon, some of the different groups that we have here, because Business Oregon, when I've met with them, they said the only place they recruit from is California, because it's the only one place we have a competitive advantage over. So these are things that would be very helpful. You guys are in the academia area where you could do this, because we want to bring those corporations to Oregon, the Intels, the Nikes, the companies like that that are going to take care of the employees and pay them well. And look out for them, because that trickles down to every small business to where now they can afford to pay more. Mm-hmm. So it's that whole effect of what the big corporation does for all of us small businesses out there. So mm-hmm. when you further your study, I don't know if you've done anything like that.
Well, Representative Holvey, Representative Widener, I wanted to reiterate something Daniel said earlier that I think is key to what you're mentioning now. The issue is not just being able to hire an educated workforce, but people aren't going to move here unless they are confident that they can get their kids educated. And I work at the University of Oregon. I almost left for a job in, wait now, Detroit, Michigan, mm-hmm. 2 years ago. What was the primary driver? They were going to pay me well, great, so did the University of Oregon, but it was the schools in Detroit, Michigan. Granted, not right in the city, but 5 minutes outside the city, I could get much better schooling for my daughter. And I know when we try to recruit at the university, one of the biggest issues we face is people start asking about the schools. How many school days are the kids in? How long are the school days? How many kids are in the classroom? It's a crisis. And I think it's a crisis for the Nike corporations, for big business. I think it's one of the biggest things we have to fix to get those corporations here.
Okay, real quickly, I'm sorry I missed part of the presentation, but were there any solutions that you guys brought forward as to what we can do? And if you did, I apologize.
Do you want to?
Yeah. I think we defined some broad solutions that many of the issues that this committee in particular is taking up, including raising wages, paid sick days, creating opportunities, expanding ERDC and other programs that help subsidize workers. And I think, you know, what we come back to time and time again is in these interviews of listening to the women we interviewed, ultimately it's about raising wages and creating more stability on the job. That time and time and time again has been the message from the interviews, and also this kind of desire to want to stand on your own two feet, to raise your own families without needing public assistance. How do we create solutions that help people do that and make ends meet through their jobs and not have to rely on public assistance? So I think that's kind of just the broad sweep of solutions that we talked about in the report and really drew from the interviews.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to illustrate what was said here about our natural resources, in 1970, when I got out of the service and got home from Vietnam and started pulling veneer green chain at night to work my way through college, I made $3.74 an hour, which doesn't sound like much, but if you compute it out today, it's $22.58 an hour. You could purchase a house, you could purchase a car, you could get married, you could raise your kids on that. And that's unfortunate that we've lost that, because what we've done is if you had a baseball team, you had a 400 hitter, we parked that 400 hitter and benched him and put in service and retail and put a 165 hitter in there, which in turn drops your whole economic vitality of the whole region. So.
Yeah, I appreciate those comments. I do, you know, I also lament when I go to Coos Bay and, you know, see all our mills shut down and those sorts of things. But I will comment, I have family members who still work in some wood products industries, and those jobs that you now say are worth 22, they're still working at $12 an hour in doing that same job. And, you know, I also lament because I see huge amounts of logs being shipped overseas. Our harvest levels are down from the 80s, but they've been pretty constant since the early 90s, you know, maybe half of what they were in the 80s, but still there's a pretty good harvest level. It's just that all those logs are going overseas. And, you know, and I'm sure that's a more profitable venture for some of the large corporations and hedge funds that own most of our private timber. But, you know, I do need to, you know, comment. I think that some of the things that have been pointed out, our economy really is, you know, improving, but the wages don't seem to go with it. And I think that's one of the statistics that they've showed is this idea that, you know, we make corporations and big business more profitable doesn't seem to trickle down to the workers, and hasn't since, you know, for the last couple of decades at least. And so I think that's one of the issues that we face, and I mean it's a big one. And without fixing that dynamic, we're left with trying to figure out how to help people survive with public assistance, which becomes a tough question because it takes more revenue. So I'm gonna, you know, have one more question. Representative Hurd, go ahead. Maybe have room for one more or two.
Just a quick statement, Mr. Chair. I've been in small business for myself for 10 years. There's only two ways employees that come to me are going to get paid more money. My foreman, I've raised his pay 35% in the last 14 months because his value has went up that much. He's taking on more responsibility. He's managing the crews while I'm here trying to do this kind of stuff. He is becoming more and more important as the weeks go by, and his pay will go up more and more as he increases his value. And that's what I continue to tell him. You work harder, you work smarter, you prove to me that you're invaluable, I will pay you more because I have to have you. The other way that people get paid more, in my opinion, and I think it's just pretty basic economics, is that when you have a roaring economy, that creates demand for employees. Without market demand, a stock's worth nothing. And we ourselves as individuals are individual stocks. The only way we fix these wage issues is we have to quit running off business. Because, see, I don't see myself as pro-business. I see myself as pro-jobs. And so whether it's the employer's job or the people he employs' jobs, you have to create market demand. And the point several people here are trying to make is that we have to quit putting the stranglehold tighter and tighter on the entrepreneurs, because without the entrepreneurs, there is no jobs. Furthermore, I'd like to see us pull back on some of our regulation because it's decimating startups, people who make... I used to work at a pizza parlor before I was self-employed, making $7.25 an hour, and I was glad to have the job. But I didn't want to stay there, so I started my own company. But I can tell you, this state made it very difficult for me. And that's the reason why I'm here, is to make this state less of an obstacle for the least of us, because the least of us are having the toughest time with the state. And the state is regulation.
Last question, Representative Nose.
More of a comment, Mr. Chair, which is...
Last comment, Representative Nose.
I think we've had a very interesting discussion here among the committee. I worry that we're sort of losing sight of the report, which is it's about... It's revealing that there's a business strategy that some of these low-wage service sectors use, which is they rely on public assistance to provide an underpinning for their workforce so that they can, you know, it's a business strategy for them. And maybe at a later date, you know, it'd be very interesting to have some of those kinds of employers come up here and explain why they use that as a business strategy or why they don't or what they're doing. I think it'd be very fascinating to have them, because $1.7 billion in public assistance to some of these, which are large corporations, I think is a very interesting commentary about what's going on.
congratulations, you got the last comment, unless the panel wants to make another comment. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's 9 o'clock. Thank you so much.
I really appreciate the work you put into this and bringing this information to us. I think it is useful for us to think about, talk about, and certainly we all have different opinions about what to do to fix the issues. And we will continue to have those differences and talk about them. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
With that, I'll close the informational meeting on the high cost of low wages in Oregon. And we're going to move on to a public hearing on House Bill 3059 and 3060. I'll open a public hearing on 3059 and concurrently open a public hearing on House Bill 3060. Jan, can you describe these two measures for us briefly?
Mr. Chair and committee members, both of these measures deal with live entertainment facilities. House Bill 3059 directs the Commissioner Boley to publish a poster regarding the rights of independent contractors and employees who perform live entertainment, and it directs the commissioner to operate a toll-free hotline that will receive inquiries and complaints from live entertainment employees, and it requires live entertainment operators to display a poster. And before you is a dash one amendment. It provides some definitions for live entertainment, what live entertainment is, and what a live entertainment facility is. And it specifies that the hotline can be staffed by someone who has a background in the operation of a crisis line. The other measure is House Bill 3060. It prohibits live entertainment facility to present live entertainment without a license that's issued by DCBS. Directs the department to periodically inspect the facility, and it allows the department to suspend the license in specified situations, and it also allows the department to assess a civil penalty for operating without a valid license. No amendments on that measure.
Thank you. So up first we have Caleb Hayes, Stanger. Excuse me. And Courtney Johnson. Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself before you start your testimony this morning.
Okay, I think I'm going to kick it off. Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Barton, Vice Chair Kennemer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Courtney Johnston, and I'm here today on behalf of the National Association of Social Workers. The National Association of Social Workers is the largest and most recognized professional association of social workers in the world, representing approximately 1,700 social workers here in Oregon. We work to advance the profession of social work, but in addition to those lobbying efforts, they also, their mission works to enhance the human well-being, particularly those most vulnerable in the community. About 8 months ago, they began to explore the issue that workers in the adult entertainment industry not only didn't get paid a wage, but in most cases had to pay to work. They asked us to explore this issue and see if this was in fact, if there were in fact abuses in this industry. We were put in contact with association member Stephanie Wahab, who is a professor at the Portland State School of Social Work and a foremost academic expert in the sex work industry. She was clear with us that the only way that our efforts were going to be successful is if we allowed this to be industry-led. And so she helped us get in touch with or put together a panel of dancers in the industry. That panel grew into a larger discussion group, and from there expanded into a coalition to include musicians, comedians, and many of whom are represented here today. We met several times to discuss this issue, and what we found was the vast majority of live entertainment workers are independent contractors. For many, there was no formal training in the industry. What they learned about their rules and regulations or their rights as workers came from their experience in the industry, from their peers in the industry, and in many cases from their managers. And that information wasn't always to the letter of the law, and it's not always in the best interest of the worker themselves. But a couple other things were made clear in these meetings that we held. First, they have very diverse views, which you're going to see here today. And we realized right away we were not going to tackle the issue of independent contractor versus employee status with this legislation. Many of these entertainers truly are independent contractors, and many of them want the freedoms and flexibility afforded to independent contractors, which I'll let them speak to. We also explored the issue of licensing live entertainers. But for this particular group, there was an understandable fear of stigmatization that can come from a traceable work history. Wow. So what you see before you here, for you here today is House Bill 3059, and that is the accumulation of our efforts. The bill would direct Boley to create a poster detailing the rights of live entertainer independent contractors. The poster would be hung in entertainment facilities where all workers, contracted or otherwise, could access it. House Bill 3059 also creates a hotline that live entertainment workers could call anonymously with questions or concerns regarding workplace safety, wage and hour issues, possible illegal activities such as sex trafficking, or any other relevant issues. The line would be operated by someone with a background as a live entertainer, someone with a background as a social worker, someone with a background working at a crisis hotline. And to speak to the hotline for a second, I think that these are a unique category of workers, and whistleblower protections are not provided to them. So we thought that this would help provide those protections. And just in closing, House Bill 3059, it aims to improve the workplace safety for all workers, regardless of industry, to improve access to workers' rights information, and to provide an avenue to help curb sex trafficking. So with that, I'll close and let my other witnesses go.
Chair Holvey, Vice Chair Barton, and Vice Chair Kennemer. My name is Elle Stanger. I've been stripping for 6 years, primarily at the Lucky Devil Lounge in Southeast Portland. I've been very actively involved in the industry. I'm the longest running female columnist for Exotic Magazine and former assistant editor for the magazine. I've won poll competitions, judged them, produced events, and I currently do nonprofit efficacy work for sex work related organizations. I published a collection of short stories last fall by strippers from around the country, which illuminates the diversity of not only the workers, but of our experiences. All of this is relevant because I may not be the epitome of the average adult entertainer in Oregon, but because of my broad reach in the industry, I've been privy to the best and the worst working conditions all over the city of Portland. Portland prides itself on being a mecca of art, culture, food, drink, and social activism, not even just for the state, but for the country. And yet, in our impactful industry of entertainers, there is no minimum safety standard or ethics standard for those workers. And why is that? I believe part of the reason is that much of
the... Can you push the mic away just a little bit? It sort of distorts when you're too close.
Oh, okay.
Even further than that, actually.
Believe it or not, I've never done this before, Chair Holden.
You're doing great.
Doing great.
Just about 8 inches is about the right distance, because then it won't distort.
Thank you. How's this?
Thank you.
Good.
Much better.
Okay. I believe part of the reason is that much of the entertainment population in Oregon is comprised of adult entertainers. Historically, women and sex workers have been targeted for violence, silenced, or just generally oppressed. And still, as evidence before you, we are people. In my line of work, I've met some of the most enlightened, intelligent people, both patrons and peers. I believe that my work as an adult entertainer is valuable and that the demand for the supply is evident. These proposed bills for a tip line and for a written statement of workers' rights would reinforce the confidence of the entertainers, not only that their work is valued, but that their person has value. Many adult entertainers fear contacting conventional middlemen, such as law enforcement or lawyers, and an anonymous social worker staff tip line would remedy that. In my years in the adult industry, I have witnessed very few instances where I suspected that sex trafficking was occurring. And yet an available contact number would help to report those that we do suspect might be involved. I do not support the exploitation of individuals, and I do not want an otherwise consensual and legitimate place of work to be used for these crimes. In speaking with literally hundreds of adult entertainers, our biggest concerns tend to be regarding health and safety. In my 6 years of dancing, I have incurred numerous injuries, not unlike an athlete. In my place of work, I feel neither endangered nor exploited, and yet I have a litany of stories from my less fortunate peers who work in other venues. If I may read a couple.
Go ahead.
I quit club name years ago when I showed up for my shift and a 12-foot by 12-foot pane of mirror had been broken out a month prior. The stages were filthy, but after 1 month, no one had bothered to clean up the broken mirror. Shards of glass gradually worked their way over the stage floor. Girls were getting cut up and risking staff infections. When I worked at Club Name, more shards of glass would fall from the mirrors and drop tiny shards on the stage. I've contracted staff and MRSA twice while dancing. Personally, I've contracted it 4 times. Being told that you're on the brink of death while suffering excruciating pain and racking up hundreds to thousands of dollars in medical bills with no chance of help from the club you were damaged in to begin with is a bummer. Clubs do not have any requirements to deal with mold in their establishments. Mm-hmm. You can see mold where the ceiling fell out in the bathroom almost a year ago, and when the heat is just right, you can smell it. I broke 3 fingers on a club stage when I was 22, and it took the owner an entire year to fill in the square hole around the base of the pole that caused it. There are hundreds of these. I personally have popped ribs out. I have glass embedded in my hand. I've had MRSA staff 4 times in 5 or 6 years. And I'd like to state that when I had MRSA, it was because I found out they were using the mop to mop the stage that they use in the men's bathroom. When I pointed this out to the owner, they got a new mop, and I have not had it since. Okay. I'd like to finish by saying that this is not a women's issue, nor a stripper's issue, nor just a worker's issue. This is a human issue, and I beg to ask why anyone would be opposed to improving humanity in any manner.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Caleb Hayes, here on behalf of the National Association of Social Workers. I'm here to just help explain the amendments that are coming and tell you a little bit about our process. So we've worked with stakeholders, including Metro and the Portland Trailblazers, on some amendments to clarify the definition of live entertainment facility. Those will be incorporated in what most likely will be dash twos. Right now, the dash ones that we have get at most of the amendments that we needed. We will have an element in there that requires anonymity or allows for anonymity with calls to the hotline and some additional language to get at what exactly is a live entertainment facility. With that, though, I'd like to thank the committee and everyone else who's helped along in this process. It's been a long road, and I appreciate the committee's willingness to take on this issue because it's important and it's long overdue. I also want to note that although our organization's name is at the top of the bill and at the request of LINE, this isn't our bill. We're proud to have helped facilitate this process, but this is L's bill. This is the bill of everyone who's come together, workers in the industry who stood up for their rights and told us what they needed. And we hope that we can get this bill passed. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Representative Barton, a question?
Comment, really. Thank you, Chair Holvey. I wanted to thank the social workers as an organization for bringing this forward. It's I suspect I speak for many of us up here. It's always quite impactful when you see an organization lobby for legislation on behalf of people not in their organization. We saw it last week with the orthopedic surgeons and mental health. Not something you in workers' comp, if you guys remember that. It's not something you typically see. Most organizations in this building, understandably and appropriately, lobby for the parochial interests of their membership, and that's fine. So anyway, I really appreciate that. I wanted to acknowledge that. It means quite a bit to us.
Representative Fagan.
Yeah, well, thank you, and good to see you all again. I really am supportive of this concept, as we've discussed in the past. In particular, the district that I represent has East Portland, and I know that L, you and I have talked about, you know, those clubs out there being very different than a lot of the clubs downtown, where there is definitely suspicion that has yet to be proven of, you know, serious kind of human trafficking issues going on in some of those kind of East Portland clubs. And so I'm a huge fan of this hotline to be able to potentially at least, you know, hopefully shine some light on those situations. I am just on a technical level curious about the hotline, because obviously this is something that's anything from there's glass on the stage to, you know, how do I get paid correctly if I'm an independent contractor, to I suspect human trafficking. So there's a really wide range of issues. So in just kind of on a technical level as an intake procedure, what do you see as an intake procedure for the hotline?
Chair Holvey, Representative Fagan, you know, the idea is that you have someone on the other end of the line who's an advocate, whether that be a social worker, someone who's worked in the industry before, or someone who's worked at a crisis line. And that person over time will develop the skills to know where to send the information, whether it be anonymous or not. And sometimes that may be law enforcement. Sometimes that might mean you keep the information right there at Boley and start a process there. Or it might mean that you reach out to OSHA. So, you know, we hope that, you know, the person that's hired to do this job will understand all of the resources available to them and use them in the best way possible.
Thank you. Appreciate you coming forward, and Elle, really appreciate your courage in bringing this issue to the forefront. We believe, or at least I do, and I think I speak for a lot of us here, that all workers have rights and deserve the protections of workers. So with that, thank you so much for bringing this to Salem. And we will hopefully work on this bill. So with that, up next I have, I apologize if I butcher these names, but Martha Calderon, Paris Mauer, Moore, Hoover, jeez, and Ray McMillan. I could read that one. Ray's a good printer.
Thank you, Chair.
She works in my district. I know where her club is.
Good morning, and if you would just remember to introduce yourself for the record before you speak.
I guess I'll go first, if it's okay. Good morning. My name is Martha Calderon. I am the NASW, MSW student representative for NAS Oregon chapter. I'm here representing NASW in support of House Bill 3059. As a social worker, I believe in our mission and our profession, which is rooted in a set of core values. One of our six core values is the inherent worth and dignity of every person. This can be found in our code of ethics. I brought it in case anybody wanted to see it. I ask that you support 3059 in providing a safer working environment for the people working in the live entertainment industry. The testimonies you've heard and you're beginning to hear and you will continue to hear will bring into perspective the unsanitary and unsafe circumstances that these artists find themselves in. I applaud the folks bringing this issue forward, and I thank them for the courage. NASW calls upon you to support House Bill 3059, and we thank you for your time.
My name is Paris Hoover, and I live in Portland, Oregon. In order for me to tell you why I'm here, I must tell you a bit about myself. I grew up in Salem, Oregon. I was a member of a lower middle class nuclear family, and my father was a small business owner. My mother worked full time. I went to grades K through 12 at Salem Kaiser School District and graduated with my diploma on time. And since moving to Portland in 2007, I've been performing around town as part of a musical comedy duo. I've also worked in other capacities on other local music, comedy, and burlesque shows, all while working low-wage jobs in the customer service sector. Last June, at the age of 26, I decided I would give being an adult entertainer a try. I did not anticipate that that would lead me here today. When I heard that there was a group of lobbyists working on a bill, I initially wanted to go in order to show support and connect with and learn from other members of our very large and diverse community. At the first meeting I attended, there were about 30 performers from venues in Portland and surrounding areas. Listening to them voice their concerns about issues within the industry and other states' attempts at regulation, I began to realize that any legislation could potentially harm performers who rely on this income in order to support themselves, their families, and who honestly enjoy the work that they do because it allows them many freedoms. I was not planning on testifying until I spoke with a member of a nonprofit organization who was concerned that the working class dancers, such as myself, would be underrepresented in these proceedings. I decided that if somebody had to stick their neck out, I would be willing to do it, given that I do not have as much to risk as somebody who's been doing our job for years. The following testimony is based on personal experiences and feedback received from a number of current and former industry professionals who could not or would not speak here today. Recurring abuses that are commonplace are ones that no other industry would allow, and performers have adapted to a broken system because they are afraid that government interference will infringe on their income and the amount of control they have over how they earn it. The main thing that industry professionals agree on is that we do not want our industry to be restricted or stigmatized any more than it already is. Oregon is one of the only states that protects artistic expression in venues that serve alcohol, and for some of us who are born here, this has always been a source of pride. Unanimously, we want this form of expression to continue to be protected, and we want our livelihood to remain intact. But there is an imbalance of power in the workplace, and little to no action that performers can take without fear of retaliation or possible career suicide. Most clubs treat their performers fairly well. The extreme cases that make the headlines are few and far between. However, misclassification of independent contractors and health and safety issues are commonplace at the majority of establishments. We do not want clubs to be shut down, causing people we work with and care about to lose their jobs. Most of us do not want to be classified as employees because we do not want to be treated as employees. We simply want our rights as independent contractors to be upheld, and House Bill 3059 is a step toward putting more power in the hands of the performers so that they can ensure that their places of business remain safe, clean, and fun entertainment establishments. Working in the nightlife industry provides us with an environment where unique personality and sense of humor is appreciated and rewarded. And as independent contractors, we are entitled to and have more freedom. For the record, I love my job. It took me 8 years of trying different kinds of professions before I found something that makes me happy, I'm good at, and allows me to support myself sufficiently. All I want is for performers to have a resource that informs them of their rights and a way to report violations of those rights or any other dangerous activity. And I ask you to support House Bill 3059 to do that.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Ray McMillan. I am born.
Can you move that mic away from you a little bit or scoot back? Thanks.
Yeah. See, I have done this before, and I'm just not paying attention. I am originally from Salem. I went to Portland State to earn a master's degree, and I basically focused in media communication, psychology, social sciences, and entertainment. And after obtaining that master's degree, due to the nature of the economy, I've been a strip club DJ for about 7 years, in addition to working with other live entertainment, such as bands, comedians, disc jockeys, and variety shows, or burlesque shows, as you call them. Something I like to say about myself is I've worked at over 24 clubs. I've been fired from one. So this is something that I choose to do. And when I leave these clubs, it is never because of pay. I am not a dancer. I just work around a lot of dancers, and I also work around a lot of things that are not associated with the adult entertainment industry at all. Every single club that I've left has a common theme of an attitude being taken toward live entertainers that sort of puts us off as disposable. And it's a gray area between 1099 contractor and W-2. And like Calvin Hayes said from PAC, where this is not an issue about wage laws. What it is the fact that we are untrained, we have no experience, and we have no resources to reach out. When I say we, if you're looking at me thinking he does not appear to be a dancer, the concerns that I've seen in the strip club industry are parallel to those that I see when I go to do live comedy, when I set up bands. I'm talking Christian rock bands, G-rated entertainment. Sometimes the same venue has a stripper pole attachment in it. So anything that affects an Oregon entertainer is going to be canonized by whatever's happening in the adult entertainment industry. An analogy I like to throw out is maybe you don't drink wine, but if you are a grape farmer, the Oregon wine industry is important to you. Therefore, if you're not a dancer or if you're adamantly opposed to Portland liberalism, etc., if you have any interest in picking up a piano at your church, you need to respect the canonization of the Oregon adult entertainment industry as setting the bar for entertainment across the spectrum. With that being said, I do currently work as a live show producer, a stand-up comic, and a disc jockey, and I find myself having to pay the same dues. So when I go down to Medford, I play a stage where there's a nail sticking out of the ground. And when I approach the bar owner, that's the industry. And I could think of no other job where this would be allowed, where I have no resources and where my peers have no resources. Again, echoing that I am not a female working in a very unequal system. I work clothed, and I still see the same effects on fellow stand-up comics and DJs and burlesque performers and my nephew's Christian rock band that the dancers are trying to advocate for today. So with all respect for the adult entertainment industry that I've grown up in, I would like to say that this is not an issue of, quote, strip clubs. This is an issue of strictly live entertainment. Another concern I have is the venues are virtually off the radar. If I go to some sort of regular workplace and something happens, I can Google who owns it, where this business is licensed out of. In strip clubs, it's often talk to Rick. That is the most specific instructions you're going to get when dealing with any kind of workplace hazards. The stories about the poles and the nail, this is not fringe random examples. This is the norm. Working in a club where I get paid on time by an owner who knows my name and has a 1099 contract form has happened twice in about 12 years. Once in Salem, once in Portland. Other than that, I've never been on the record as anything other than DJ Hazmat in a situation where people are naked and doing acrobatics while drinking. Which brings me to my third point, and that is the Oregon Liquor Control Commission is a private organization. Whether or not we like to accept it is basically a private organization. When a minor, read 18 to 20 years old, is caught drinking in one of the clubs I've worked at, or any of the clubs I've worked at, if she were to fall over and hurt herself or himself, doesn't matter. The biggest issue is the OLCC. And if the owner finds out they might be facing a fine, they sober that minor up, they put her in the back, they take care of her. If a girl's 22 years over and she's been intoxicated and falls over, tough expletive. So the fact that the Liquor Control Commission is a bigger threat to people that are putting naked human beings on stage for other people's entertainment is shocking. The OLCC should not be doing a better job keeping our entertainers safe than the state. And as far as putting out the agenda of a hotline or some sort of advocacy line, I'd like to make two quick points before I get off the mic. One is that 911 receives phone calls for horrible things. Like you're asking, how do we separate human trafficking from Destiny didn't pay her stage fee? And that's a good question, but that is also the cost of doing business to make sure people are not being subject to human trafficking. And personally speaking, as a previous volunteer for crisis lines, I have no problem spending 8 hours on a phone call talking people down from a ledge if that saves one person from being trafficked. I have lost dozens of friends to this industry. I don't mean heroin overdoses. I don't mean drunk driving. I mean lost. I have friends that are missing that have no record of where they've gone. Last place they were seen is in some club, 137th and Gunshot out in Portland. You never hear from them again. At a construction site, we're not trying to unionize here. At a construction site, there's signs from OSHA saying what you're allowed to do to your employees. If I contract someone to do my landscaping, I cannot treat him or her with the same amount of negligence and disposability that live entertainers are being treated with. And to close on this, we are not some fringe group. And I understand that I might be an anomaly saying that I am pro strip club industry. If you are disgusted by it, that is fine. But I'd like you to consider what you do like, jazz music or golf or whatever it is you watch. The Oregon strip club industry, we have more strip clubs per capita than anywhere else. So what the Oregon strip club industry says about entertainment is what Oregon says about entertainment. And I see a lot of the same trends working as a stand-up comic that my peers do working as naked entertainers. Those two jobs have nothing to do with each other. One of us should be introducing the other one. We should not be worried about glass and nails. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. I should have asked this before, but I was kind of curious that if you get hurt and you're an independent contractor, you have workers' comp?
Not that I know of. I was never told of any sort of precautions or anything or any sort of recourse if I were to get injured on the job. It's just more like if you can't dance, then you can't work. You need to go home. I have had friends who've seriously injured one of their shoulders, or another friend ruptured her ACL while doing pole work, and she needed to be in a knee brace, but she could not wear that on stage, but she could not afford to take time off in order to rest her knee because she relied on that income in order to take care of her children.
If I may interject, Chair Olvey, members of the committee, we have a group called the Cupcake Girls. It's basically a volunteer organization that goes from club to club providing them with things like Band-Aids, ointment. And that's the perspective we're trying to put in here. It's we are not even thinking about workers' comp or health insurance. We want to know where the Band-Aids are. So we'll work up to everything else later.
Not seeing any other questions at this time. Thanks for sharing your perspectives on this, and I appreciate you coming down and enlightening us a little bit.
Thank you for having us.
Up next, I have Claude D.
Took a lot of pokes.
DeCourcy?
Oh, yeah.
That was tough. And Joel Shapiro?
Former governor.
Definition.
Yeah, it was interesting. It was kind of awkward for a school.
Who's that?
Same guy.
Oh, it's a rose.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I am.
Could you introduce yourself to the record, please?
Hi, Chairman Holvey, Vice Chair Barton, and Kenimer's not here, but to him as well. My name is Claude DeCourcy. I represent the Oregon Association of Club Executives, which is the adult trade association that represents operators, owners, and up until recently, everybody else who is associated with this industry. I am here in support of House Bill 3059 as the industry representative, although not everybody will agree with as an industry. I think as an industry as a whole, we think this is a good and appropriate bill to go forward. Listening to some of the comments from my industry representatives, L. Ray Paris, I noticed and took some notes as they were talking. Ethics was raised, and you know that sometimes raises an eyebrow, ethics in what we do. And it's not ethics in what we do as far as nude entertainment or entertainers doing their making money the way they're making money. Ethics in how we conduct ourselves, ethics in how we do our business, ethics in how we treat the people, all people who work in our industry. That's being entertainers, managers, operators, bartenders, waitresses, anybody, customers, patrons. I think that's the key, is that we represent ethics in what we do. It's a very important thing. And as an operator myself, I operate with an ethical lens that determines, in my personal opinion, what is right and what is wrong. And listening to some of the issues that have come across, nails on a stage, broken glass, mops being used to mop up bathrooms as well as the stage that entertainers use, that is not an ethical or a practical, it's not anything when it comes to business and what we do. And that should not be acceptable by any means. Listening to that, it's sickening. The issues that are raised are extreme and are troubling. And I myself, somebody who represents the industry, kind of cock my head and go, how could that happen? How is that going on? And it's been brought to my attention that what my normal is not necessarily what other normal is. And we hear that where some of the people who have testified have said that there's no training. There's no, what do I do if I step on a nail? And to us, that may seem as commonplace. Well, go get a Band-Aid. Well, where is the Band-Aids? That doesn't seem like a good operation. And to allow our entertainers, which is the basis of our business. Without them, we are nothing. We are just a bar with overpriced liquor.
Mistakes.
And that's, you know, that's we don't want to, it's funny, but it's the truth. I mean, what I do is I manage a bar with Nude Entertainment. That is what I do, you know, and I love what I do, and I love the people who I work with. I love the people who represent it, our industry, from attorneys to operators to entertainers, you know, and it is troubling to us as operators to hear this. One point I want to make is that these issues are you know, these operations that have these issues are a small percentage. The majority of operators and operations in the state of Oregon would not accept any of these conditions as normal. The issue is that the analogy of a rotten apple ruins a bunch. And that's what we have right now. We have a couple rotten apples that are causing this issue and to cause us to all be here today talking about this. We don't want to see irresponsibility in an industry that's already scrutinized and criticized so much. It is not something that we want. We don't need another issue to bring us out in the open. Well, we most operations, and I'm just speaking candidly here, most operations care, and we try to make sure that everybody is taken care of. I would not be here today if I did not think this was an issue that we need to take care of and we need to be around and think about. I'm very upset that we got to this point. Not that we have come to you to consider a bill, but to the point that in our entertainers had to get together and they couldn't call me, they couldn't talk to their manager and go, hey, there's a problem. So the problem isn't necessarily that there's glass on the stage or the pole isn't connected securely or they don't know where the band-aids are at. The problem is that people didn't care enough to actually tell them what they can do, where they can do it, how they can do it, why they can do it. So I support this hotline in 100% as my official position as president of the trade association, as my personal position as a manager who works at these venues. With that being said, I will finish in. Let Joel speak.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, thank you for hearing these bills. I'm Joel Shapiro. I'm here because I have worked on the issue of human trafficking for about the last 6 years, starting at the federal level when I served as chief counsel with Senator Wyden, and we introduced the first bill to focus on domestic sex trafficking of minors. When most people hear the word human trafficking, they think immediately of places like Southeast Asia and Eastern Europe. And I'm glad that we're here to talk about the issue of how people are exploited within the United States, because the highest volume of people who are trafficked in the U.S. are vulnerable teenagers and overwhelmingly women, females, girls. And so this bill is not explicitly about that, but I'm glad that you're hearing some testimony because we have I'm here to give you a little bit of the background. And during the last legislative session, I worked closely with Representative Tomei, who put together a work group that met from the end of last session through the interim. And that consisted of service providers, state agencies, law enforcement, to try to figure out how we can continue to make progress on this issue, which we have been doing in Oregon. And the members who serve on the Judiciary Committee, and Representative Barton is here, have done a lot of work on this issue, and particularly Representative Barton, and we thank them for that. And so we had a chance to talk with the NASW folks. Caleb and Courtney came to some of our work group meetings. That work group transitioned from Representative Tomei to Representative Huffman and Representative Taylor, and there have been some other legislators involved as well. But we know that there are many venues out there that are not having an issue of human trafficking, and there are some that are. And so I'm not here to try to paint with an overly broad brush, but, you know, we're necessarily talking in generalizations. I do want to mention, I think probably the members of the committee are familiar with the instance that happened in Stars in Beaverton, where there was a 13-year-old girl who was being trafficked out of the club. Both one of the managers of the club and her pimp were prosecuted in that case. It wasn't until she was removed from that situation, had been at a shelter in Arizona, because at the time we didn't have a shelter in Oregon. We now do, that was funded by the legislature last October in the special session and is now operating. But there are not enough resources, and it wasn't until this particular girl was in a safe place and had gone through quite a bit of counseling and treatment that she could come forward and explain what had happened to her, and it was linked back to this club. I was contacted by KGW when the story broke, and the reporter said, "Can you believe that this was going on?" I said, "Yes, I can believe this is going on, because this does happen. This is not an aberration. There is a risk of people that are in the adult industry being exploited, and people, girls who are underage, being that the venue of a strip club can be used. So what I'm here to say is that anything that we can do to raise awareness and provide resources that people who are victimized can find some avenue to try to get some help and get some resources will be helpful. I don't think that these bills are, you know, a panacea. They're not gonna cure everything, but I do, and I am not even here to say that these bills are perfect, because I'm not an expert on live entertainment venues or the adult industry across the board. I've worked in service industries. I've worked in restaurants. I know that things can vary a lot, depending on who's there, who the manager is, how things run, and so. To the extent that more avenues to try to get some oversight are available, I think that would be helpful. Why do we not have enough oversight right now? I think there are a number of reasons. The Oregon Constitution provides very broad protections, as you've already heard in this hearing. So to focus on one particular segment that provides adult entertainment is probably not possible. Under equal protection. And that's why these bills are crafted very broadly, in my opinion. And BOLI is a complaint-driven agency that does not have the resources to go out and see what's going on every day or every month or even probably quarterly. But I do think that providing a poster, providing a hotline, and providing some licensing and oversight will be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. I wanted to bring the agencies up, and we're running out of time. I just have one question. I guess, and either one of you can answer it. I know a lot of these entertainers are, you know, want to be independent contractors, and for whatever reason they get tip money and things like that. But I'm curious. As an independent contractor, they probably, are missing a lot of the employee protections that exist as an employee. So how do you determine if an individual entertainer, when you employ them on a basis, is an independent contractor?
Well, there is the BOLI test, I believe. Most operations within our industry will, we don't, and I can't speak for every operation. I can only technically speak for the operation I have control over, which is what I do. They make their own schedules. They pick when they work. They come and go as they please. They do, they act as independent contractors. The protections that
they work for other
They work for other venues. They can. Venues, I mean, as well. It is a pretty good gig when it works right. The protections that I'm allotted as an employee, that doesn't necessarily transfer over to them. I can speak from experience, though, when an entertainer has hurt themselves while performing on one of our stages, we usually do everything we can to cover their medical costs, just because that's the right thing to do. Now, not every employer is going to do that, or every club operation is going to do that, but, I mean, if you are an electrician and get electrocuted at a job site, what is your recourse? You know, do you sue PG&E? Do you go after the people who employed you? The right thing to do is just to take care of those who get injured while in your operation.
All right, thank you.
Yeah,
I'd like to go ahead and bring up Michael Woods from Oregon OSHA and Paloma Sparks, if she's willing, and maybe somebody to represent the workers' comp side of the world. Just
Teresa, excellent.
Teresa's always a good sport.
She is a good sport. So. Thank you for signing up to testify. I suppose I'd, open it up. I know Joel Michael actually signed up to testify, so maybe we'll start out with his short testimony first.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Wood, and I'm the administrator of the Occupational Safety and Health Division of the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services, which, for probably obvious reasons, we shorten typically to Oregon OSHA. And being perfectly capable of taking a hint, I will let you see my written comments. And just note that, as Chair Holvey has already indicated, the primary issue for us is the employer-employee relationship. If the employer-employee relationship exists, we have jurisdiction. Our jurisdiction isn't limited to particular industries such as construction or manufacturing. We broadly have jurisdiction over workplaces where employees are exposed or may be exposed to injuries throughout the state. And the test for us usually comes down to issues related to direction and control. I will also say that generally, it is not unusual when we look at what the employer believes to be an independent contractor relationship, whether that's in construction, whether that's sometimes in manufacturing, housekeeping, any number of areas, that we conclude that, in fact, there is direction and control and there is an employer-employee relationship there, and we act accordingly. We are able to take complaints. We do respond to complaints. We also do scheduled inspections. This particular industry in our existing scheduling system, we would inspect the average place of employment once every 40 years. So I wouldn't say that based on our scheduling system it's particularly robust. That is actually slightly higher than average, but the
4 years?
40.
40.
0, correct?
That's 4 longer 0. Than I've been alive.
4 0.
40? Oh my God.
Yes. We oh, wow.
And is that typical, or is it because of the employer-employee relationship?
It has nothing to do with the employer-employee relationship. It's based on factoring in various injury data, fatality data within the industries, looking at the industrial classifications. And so, for example, for a foundry, we would typically inspect a foundry, which is in our highest risk category. We typically inspect those a little less frequently than once every 3 years. So it's not, even in our highest risk industries, the notion that we would be there monthly or quarterly isn't necessarily the case.
Whoa, you just sparked a whole bunch of questions here. First, where do you get your funding? No, I'm Representative Fagan.
So my question is pretty technical based on what we're doing here with this bill. So we're creating a hotline where I would expect to maybe see a greater volume of complaints to OSHA. When you have your formula for how frequently you inspect a place, is it literally complaints about that workplace, or
is it complaints by employees at that workplace? So, for example, if dancers were to begin to call, but you were to find that, you know, a certain volume of them were not employees, would those not be counted as injuries on the workplace for purposes of your, you know, how often you inspect it?
Okay. Chair Holvey, Representative Fagan, the scheduling system that I referred to is actually separate and apart from the issue of a worker complaint. So a worker complaint, depending on the severity of that complaint, the severity of the hazards alleged, the issues we're looking at, will always result in an inquiry that we describe as an investigation or perhaps an inspection. The point I was trying to make is that absent worker complaints, it's relatively unlikely that we would be doing inspections of these establishments on our own initiative.
Every 4 years.
Teresa, just a quick question before I move on, so I don't lose track of this one. Do independent contractors in any scenarios receive workers' compensation insurance?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Teresa Van Winkle, Senior Policy Advisor for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. In general, no. The answer is no.
Yeah.
If you would like, Mr. Chair, I can offer for you, for lack of time, without you testing me on the ins and outs of independent contracting, I can provide to the committee a primer from the website in regards to the different agencies and their litmus tests on what constitutes independent contracting. And
along with what kind of benefits are available or what kind of requirements are if there are any, I suppose, of independent contractors to provide themselves with insurance. Anyway, who is next? Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just if I may comment, having professionally worked with a small number of these ladies in the very difficult transition to a more traditional life, I would say the most profound thing we could do would be to help them have status as workers, as employees. Mm-hmm. They have no rights, and they have no backup. And being paid under the table and all these things that go on undermine their ability to transition into a, if I may say, maybe it's a value judgment, but a more favorable or
I'd
a
say
more positive lifestyle.
A little bit of a value judgment there, perhaps. Representative Barton.
Thank you. Question of you, Mr. Wood. So first of all, I want to acknowledge, I mean, we do this to you all the time. The legislature, we don't invest enough resources in your department, and then we complain about you not doing it. All right? I am sympathetic. Having said that, you know, it seems like the current approach that your department uses seems to assume, I suppose, the reliability of the data. And there might be certain industries, for example, where, for various reasons, people might be less likely to report to a government agency. But there are about unsafe work conditions or injuries. Is there anything that your organization can do to account for that potential data discrepancies?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barton, I think you raise a very good point. The data sources that we look to assess risk across an industry include the workers' compensation data and data gathered by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Now, of course, those both depend on an assessment being made that we're dealing with an employer-employee relationship. To the extent that injuries occur and that everyone believes they're outside of that relationship, even if, in fact, that's not the case, or under law that's not the case, it's likely that those would not get reported. And I think that that is a limitation of the data. One of the struggles we have is we have, both as a good practical measure of trying to target our limited resources and also a statutory direction, we have to identify those places of employment that are most likely to be unsafe. And it's difficult to do that without some data source that we could draw on. If there is a way to access other data, we certainly can look at changing the methods we use in order to assess those industries.
Brief follow?
Real briefly.
So, thank you for the answer, Mr. Wood. What can this committee or this legislature do aside from, I mean, you can see our reactions. We care about safety of everyone, of entertainers and everyone. What can we do to help you perhaps take a look at this industry and see what safety, what we can do?
Chair Holvey, Representative Barton, that's an important question that I think would require a thoughtful answer and probably an answer that would require more thought than I'm able to give it right now, but I'd be happy to follow up with you.
Thank you.
My answer would be a budget note. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think as we're looking at this, I'm seeing lots of different things come into play, and I mean, Mr. Wood, you can let me know if this works into OSHA, but I'm almost seeing some things with the county health inspector. Like when I had a restaurant, we pay $600 a year to the health inspector. They come in twice a year, and they would make sure that everything's, all the food prep, all of that stuff's done right. And I'm wondering if we should be looking at other agencies, whether it's OLCC, you. I mean, it looks like we're missing the boat on multiple groups coming in and looking at what's happening in these facilities and come up with the plan for handling these clubs and the way they should be maintained and ran, all the way from food safety to liquor control to, I mean, even police with the trafficking and everything. And that's where I actually commend Representative Barton for the sex trafficking stuff with the signs to be put up in these places with the bill that he's worked on a couple sessions ago. So I don't know what your thoughts are on this, but how involved OSHA wants to be. I know we need you there looking at these facilities, though, and what we need to do. It might be a fee that we just do to the whole industry if you're a registered sex club, or not, sorry, but I don't, a live entertainment facility, you pay $600 a year, or whatever it is.
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, it's certainly true that there are other regulatory entities that focus on public health issues. It's also true that when you look at those particular establishments, jurisdiction over the health of the workers still ends up tending to fall into our lap and being handled outside the context of those twice yearly inspections. It isn't something that we're necessarily resourced to staff at the same level.
Paloma, for the Bureau of Labor and Industries, has this industry, you know, come up in investigations and in determinations of wage claims and or independent contractor status to Bowling?
For the record, Paloma Sparks with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, yes, we have conducted various investigations. We receive complaints every once in a while from dancers. It varies how those turn out. In some cases, we determine that those workers are, in fact, employees. Sometimes they're independent contractors. When we have done sort of investigations on our own initiative, the biggest problem that we encounter is reluctance for workers to talk to us about their working conditions.
So in terms of wage claims, if a worker comes to you and they're actually an independent contractor, their remedy is not through BOLI for recovering money as an independent contractor?
That's correct. We can't do anything in terms of, if they are not employees, we cannot help them.
I guess I'll turn to my labor attorney and see what independent contractors do besides getting an attorney and going to court.
They have contract remedies. They're contractors.
Right.
I mean, that's what they have, is contract remedies.
Right.
If they have a contract.
But so any other questions of our agencies on this? Thank you. I appreciate you being willing to come up and just sort of highlight a couple things for us. It appears this issue is complicated for certain, but I'm hopeful we can make some improvements for this industry. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
No one else was signed up to testify. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3059 and close the public hearing on House Bill 3060. Any other news?
No news.
Good of the order. We
we were carrying over the two work sessions I announced previously. I'll go ahead and finish that. They were carrying over House Bill 2805 and House Bill 2386. With that, I'll adjourn the committee on House Committee on Business and Labor. House Committee on Business and Labor.